Accession number 9433, reel 10.
Mr. A.J. Smith, Reel 10. We were talking about unrest.
About demobilisation. Yes.
Could you continue?
Well, now, we lived quiet lives down there. We didn't hear a lot. But one day, we were called out on parade. Instead of going to the ordnance depot, which was about a quarter mile away, half a mile away, they said, get into all your equipment, fighting gear and everything, tin hats, everything. Your guns, we'll serve you out ammunition. We were all paraded up for I don't know how long, standing around and then being numbered off and I don't know what not, all in fighting order. They said there's unrest up, say, near Arras or somewhere like that amongst the troops who were complaining about demob, slowness of demob. You've got to go up there and get order back again. So,
did you think of that when you were first told?
Well, first of all, we were pleased to be, there were plenty of, the wax camp was right next to us. We were delighted that they saw us all in full fighting uniform with bayonets, rifle. It's silly, it's all silly now, but at the time we were very bucked. We were troops. The people they'd worked with at the base were just ordinary people, you know, were just base wallers. It's absurd, but young people may be absurd at 18 or 9, well, 18, 19. So I'm afraid we were rather pleased with ourselves. Anyhow,
what did you think about the side of it though, about going to stop troops from protesting and rioting or whatever?
We didn't think anything about it. We thought, well, that's a change. I mean, you quite frankly at that age and in the army, you don't think too much for yourself. That's the idea of the army, partly of course. And we didn't think anything about it. We thought, right, we'll be off. We never have a change. But I suppose by the evening they dismissed us and back went the ammunition and we kept all our equipment as usual. And that was all over. Now that's all we heard, but there must have been unrest and that must have been about June, May, June, sometime like that.
Was it before or after that incident you were involved in when they refused to drill?
Well, that was... we refused to drill fairly early on. But this was a month or two later. Yes, a month or two or more later. But you've got to remember, all the people that refused to drill were young. We were all youngsters.
You said that the older ones with jobs and such like were worried about get demob. How about you younger ones? What did you think about demob?
We didn't really think it seems absurd. We knew we wouldn't get it because last in, last out. We knew we wouldn't be demobbed. We were told quite plainly. We knew we were taking other places. Now jobs, well, I didn't want to go back to mine particularly, not having wandered about a bit more and talked to people. And particularly as during the war, in one occasion we did get in a barn during the actual fighting time. And I looked across the barn, there were about 70 of us in this barn, and lo and behold, across the way was a chap who was in the sea insurance in the city when I was in it for the 3 months. And naturally, I got up, he got up, we met in the middle and talked a little while. What annoyed me rather much was he said, oh, the company are still paying our salary, salaries, so we've got a bit to go back to. They actually were. The sea insurance were paying their salary. Well, I'm afraid they were. That's the city, you see, they do things properly. So in my mind, the city was the only place later on. But that was astonishing to look across. I was lying down, he was lying down, it was late, and on straw and hay and stuff. And then we recognised each other and strolled across, and it was amazing. It does happen. Some, not much like that, but occasionally.
How would you have felt if you'd been sent to Russia or to one of the other more active places?
That we would not have thought that was too good, I think. We should have thought, we would have thought that was healthy. I can't say what we thought. We'd already had one disappointment, because unless you were, I think, 20, a lot of, or 19, it must have been fairly early on in Phoneme. Unless you were, if you were, if you were, you've got to be 19, I think, in order to be sent to Egypt. Now, a lot went off to Egypt because they were 19, 20, or 21. Now, that we were terribly disappointed over, because that would have been quite something to go off to the Mediterranean. We wanted to go. White Russia, no. We shouldn't have wanted Archangel or anywhere there. I don't know. We'd have gone, of course, because in the army you do as you're told. And especially, I say, when you're young, it doesn't matter. We had no commitments of any sort. Oh, the one, I say, Hedges that died, he had a girl and a photograph of her, and they were going to get married. She was going to manage and look after the old man, the father, who was an invalid. And so on. We had none of that. All the little crowd I was with, we were absolutely free.
So how long were you at the RAOC?
About 3 or 4 months. Just about 3 or 4 months, during which time we did, it was a very interesting time. The other RAOC office people were quite educated chaps, and the WACs were very classy, nice types, very interesting chatting. And trouble is, this is a silly point, I went on leave while I was there. When I came back, the girl said, how many theatres did you go to? Well, being a Wesleyan in those days, you didn't really think theatres were good places. So the most I could say, I went to Masculine Defence one night, which was a magic show. I don't know whether you know it, or it's a good while ago. Masculine Defence were famous, and that's all I could say. They thought I would be at the theatre every night and so on, touring around, but I'm afraid not. 3 months, yes, about 3 months or so.
So you'd leave round about August?
Something like that. Then we went off to Dunkirk or something like that, into the Assistant Controller of Labour. We shifted into that group, and there we lived in a very nice house where the walls were covered with sacking sort of stuff, and I wondered why, but they said, good gracious, under there there's some lovely paintings which were, they were protected with all this covering. It was a lovely house in Dunkirk itself, and Dunkirk's a very nice city or town.
Were you still nominally Royal Sussex?
We were still Royal Sussex, yes, right to the demob.
And there who exactly were you working for?
We were working for the British Army. It would be a sort of, I don't know who, which group of the British Army. We were arranging prisoners of war, German prisoners of war, for doing jobs. Well, one big job they were on was clearing the sand from, is it Marlow-les-Bains, which is next to Dunkirk? I think it is Marlow, going north. We had umpteen, lots and lots of German prisoners with barrows. The sand had got right up against the houses, right from off the beach, right across the promenade, and that was one of our jobs, arranging to so many prisoners from the prisoner of war camps round about to do that job, and other various jobs that prisoners could do. We were sort of the allocation assistant controller of labour, with the sort of allocating people.
Has it anything to do with the Royal Engineers?
It could, it sounds a bit like it, although it's not quite technically minded sort of stuff. It was keeping these prisoners doing odd jobs. We had bicycles, by the way, which we used to cycle out and enjoy the sunshine on the beaches up north of Dunkirk. That was quite something. Army cycles, good strong ones.
What was your actual role yourself? What were you doing?
Sitting at a desk with a very nice fellow who had been a railway clerk in London, and we just filled in endless forms and numbers. And
clerical again.
Just clerical, entirely clerical.
Was
and
this
very
dealing
little
with the prisoners of war or was, and what they were going to do? What sort of clerical, what were the documents about?
The documents would be the number of people at Dunkirk, the number of people at some other part of the area around there and that were working, and another group would send out the orders to the officers in charge of the prisoner of war camps to get these men out, and I suppose we had to arrange for transport. It was a very easy time. A lot of talking went on because we hadn't got an awful lot to do. In fact, there were a lot of people there to do the work, quite a number of us in this place. And we had a cook from Durham Way, oh dear, and his assistant, who I suppose was nearly Scottish, and when they quarrelled, you couldn't tell a word, and they quarrelled fairly often, cook and his assistant for all of us, you really couldn't tell what they were saying. They argued and went like mad at each other. No harm done, it was probably discussing something, I don't know, it sounded like a row. But they were both good at their job, so we had very good meals.
There was no question of sending the German POWs back at this time, was there, to Germany?
No, they were being kept to do the work. And further up country, I suppose they were mending roads and all that. They destroyed them, let them get on with it and do some of the repair work. Mind you, they were not unhappy. Of course, they were lovely jobs, well fed. No, they were not unhappy at all. They were glad to miss the war, to have survived the war.
Was there any sign of further unrest amongst British troops in the Dunkirk area trying to get home?
No.
Because it's getting late 1919 now.
Oh, yes, it's 1919. No, there was no other unrest. The jobs were all rather comfortable jobs, scattered round. But there was the terrible uncertainty of the older men as to where their jobs. By older, I mean over 20, 25, and that about the jobs. The one I sat opposite, he was a civil servant, so he was well away. That's funny, he was a civil servant in Ireland. That's before Ireland became ERA. So his job was perfectly safe. He didn't hurry. I think I still left him there in June. He was perfectly content to be there chatting the wax up. Oh, yes, he used to have little struggles. He was very well educated, very nice chap, but the whack, one tiny, we called it, charade, they would sort of scrap, not wickedly, but push around. It sounds silly now, but it was quite good fun. So he was very happy, very quiet sort of man. And, oh dear, he made a phrase which I've thought of since. I told him, he saw that this sergeant was showing me a lot, showing all how the guns were fitted together and all that. And when I said something, it was very nice of him. He said, well, he's putting all his goods in the shop window. It's a phrase I've remembered to look out for, to not to do. But yes, he said he's putting all his goods in the shop window, which was a little unkind, but it was true. He was telling me everything he knew. I didn't see any harm in that, but it was a phrase I've remembered ever since.
That was at Vondreux?
That was at Vondreux.
How long were you at Dunkirk?
At Dunkirk, it went on till demob, so that would be, demob was December, demob in December.
What happened when you were demobbed?
I suppose what happened, we got into some very, we were moved nearer Column Camp, ready for transport in the ship. We were moved to Column Camp, which was on the top of a hill or some. It was very, very cold. There was a lighthouse flash around all the time. We had a day or two there. I suppose they were booking in and arranging shipping and all sorts of things. Or that'd be another group controlling. And eventually, after two or three days at that, a boat came along. We were put on. We went over and by train up to Crystal Palace. I don't think we stayed at Crystal Palace. They just relieved us of equipment and all that sort of thing. They gave us 30 shillings or 25 shillings for a new suit. They gave us about £2 or so, £2 or £3 for a month's food. And then we were off home in uniform. That's right, yes, of course, in uniform, off home. And that was it. That was at the end, towards the end of December. 19.
How did you get back into? Did you ever think of staying in the army?
No. A number of our youngsters did. I was surprised. Quite several of them did. No, not for a moment did we think of that. I don't know why, but no, we didn't. Didn't think of that. But several did stay. And how they got on, I don't know.
So how did you fare back in civilian life?
I did odd jobs in the nursery. I didn't go back to Barker's. I set my eyes on the city. It took a little while, but I could always do something in the nursery, so I wasn't lazy or anything. Various kind people at the church were telling me various jobs, and then it came to an inspector of taxes at the church. I went to see him, because the trouble was I arrived back when all the jobs had gone, nearly everybody, and all the sort of good jobs had gone to the ex-officers, and they deserved them because they had a lot to do with the war, the officers. They'd taken over lots of jobs. I mean, they'd been given jobs and grants too. They deserved it, there's no doubt about it. And so this inspector of taxes, well, said you won't be satisfied with the civil servant. That's funny. I think I would have been, but still, he said you won't be satisfied with the civil service. But very kindly, he sent me to several of his people, in the accountants that he dealt with in the city, and two or three of those, he gave me the names. He phoned the people up and said he was sending me along to see them. They were most charming, but of course they'd got ex-officers, subsidised ex-officers working. There was a government grant made, small grants, and they really couldn't take anybody else on. So eventually I found one, a chap he'd been in the army 3 years, and he'd gone into partnership with a very old man, and it was the secretary of the Society of Incorporated Accountants Orders. There were two societies then, the Incorporated and the Chartered, and the secretary sent me along to this man as a likely person, and so he interviewed me, and funnily enough he just pushed a paper with a column of figures and said add that. Well, of course I did that in about no difficulty at all. I mean, that was very easy. Anyhow, he said, the fee will be 100 guineas. You had to pay fee in those days. Now they do the reverse, but in fee 100 guineas. Well, now, my father, I think I told you earlier on, he'd rebuilt the whole at the beginning of the war at a great cost. Anyhow, he had a life policy come due, £112, £120, something like that, so he willingly supplied that. And mind you, I had to do 2 or 3 months. They didn't agree to articles straight away. You had to prove that you would be all right. So anyhow, the 100 guineas was paid, and I became an article clerk. Wages, first year 15 shillings, the next year £1, the next year 25, the next year got to 35, and I think got to 40 in the end. Now that's the wages of those days for article clerks, and there was no way out of it if you wanted to become something. So that's how that happened, and I stayed there the 5 years. I had one old bad patch. I heard, or it was announced, that people who had been in the army could cut their articles from 5 years to 4 years. So I suggested it to this partner, and he didn't speak to me for 6 weeks afterwards. I worked in the office, we passed papers to each other, and he didn't speak for 6 weeks. And then I said, well, I wouldn't take it, you know, I wouldn't go for the year's reduction. I mean, it was all petty, but it happened at the time. They did try and make it easier for older people to get through the 5 years. So, but that did happen, actually.
How did you feel your years in the army and the war had affected you, mentally or physically?
Well, I think they did a lot of good, really. Because you get a feeling if you survive that, you can survive anything.
Was it a very bad experience? I mean, was it something you look back at with regret or horror? Or
No regrets and no horrors. It was it was a different war from the second war in that people volunteered a lot in the first war. We were called up being late comers, but so that the whole thing was a sort of a pilgrimage. Mind you, they had Hitler in the second war. They were fighting against Hitler's slavery and so on. No, I had no regrets at all. Well, you see, I had no wife, no friend, no girl, no nothing. So I didn't have any regrets. And there were, and you see, wartime, you were in a trench. You're on gas duty. If you were in reserve back some, a little way back, you're on gas duty. You're standing there, and just nearby you can see somebody lying half up with field glasses. It's dark and night. You just move a few paces and say hello straight away. They say hello. You find that he's an artillery spotter. He's watching for the SOS three lights that go up in the sky. If there's an attack on a certain part of the line, on the line anywhere, they'll send up an SOS signal. And he will then phone back to the battery. He's got a line going all along the ground to the battery. And you chat then, when if nothing's happened, you chat about life, where he came from, where you came from. It was also gloriously, everything was friendly, you see. It was a sort of good time that you could talk to anyone. That was, I remember that chap, whoever he was. Mind you, there was a funny scene there. I was the only one with a wristwatch in our platoon. Now, the sergeant doesn't want to come keep awake and come along and tell you when the hour's up. You each do an hour, say, in a night from say 9 o'clock onwards till 6 or 5 or 6 next morning. Each to do an hour. So I was the only one with a watch. So the first night I handed my watch over to the first one, and each was to pass the watch on after the hour. Well, I was to be the last one. Well, when I came on, I could see it wasn't anywhere near the time, because it was still very dark, not even anything. What they'd done is, each one had pushed on, they hadn't done their hour, they just wound the clock on a bit to look like the hour. And so I think someone did about quarter an hour and then turned the clock, woke the next person and said, "Here you are." They'd wound the watch on to the hour, the full hour. So I came on very early and had two or three hours. I didn't lend the watch in future. But that was taken in good fun. They meant no harm. It was just something that could be done without anyone growling or grumbling. It was funny. Much laughter, of course, next day. I mean, and as I say, the sergeant didn't want to come round fetching each one out on guard. There were all those sort of things which were so very pleasant, really. And there was a terrific lot of sort of kindness in a way to each person. I mean, you shared your parcels, you shared this, you shared. It was very good.
Was your religious, you know, the Wesleyan background, did that help, and the religious side of that, did that help you get through the worst times, or was it not a factor?
You see, I might say there were a lot of prayers said on Epi Day, but then all young people in those days had scripture and prayers every morning. They don't get it, I believe, now, every morning, every day at school. So they were all on the praying side. If there was a really tight, whatever you say, people do pray on certain occasions seriously, and that epi business was a do. Unfortunately, my mother she kept all my letters. She handed them over to me, and I dumped them in a boiler. We had a big central heating boiler in Kew where we lived, and I threw it in that. One day, I suppose, I thought, well, it's no good, years are going on. She had died. We loaded up with stuff, and away it went. But I know in one of those letters after Epi, I said, we said a lot of prayers that day. I know that actually happened in a letter. But why I destroyed that? I've wanted those letters a lot since, for various reasons. But I threw that. She packed them in a nice bundle, and I threw the whole lot in the boiler, which was a big central heating boiler outside. Why? I suppose we were busy. I mean, when we loaded up with so much stuff. But I'd have liked to have kept them. But I do remember that. So the Methodist part, the Wesleyan part, well, it made you live very decently, and it affected all the rest of your hut, undoubtedly. There wasn't swearing to any extent, and there was no gossipy talk, no sexy talk of any sort ever in a hut where I was. There was another one, he was a Baptist. And it has a very good effect, I'm sure. Mind you, the people were decent anyhow. They'd been to school and they'd all had plenty of training, teaching.
Which religious services would you attend?
A non-conformist. Oh, that's why I survived the war, sorry. We were paraded, we were right up with the details. We were well up towards the line before joining in the actual battalion, and there was a church parade. So fall out the nonconformists, so I fell out, and the Baptists and or Congregationalists, and they all fell out, and a Jew boy as well. We only had one Jew. He fell out, and so we went off to our service. When we came back, quite a lot of the group had gone. There'd been a call for volunteers to go up early, before the general run, because of the heavy casualties. And so I could well have been killed, as were a number of ours. A Lance Corporal Dietz, whose memorial is at Teddington, he's on the memorial there, he was one. They, of course, stepped forward. There was that keenness amongst youngsters. And when we came back, we were much smaller in numbers because this group had volunteered. They rushed them up to just to fill. Mind you, when they got to the battalion, I suppose, said, oh, yes, another stunt. You see, yes, when I came back, quite a lot had gone up. So that probably saved my life. That sounds ridiculous, but might as well say it. I've often thought it was funny to go off to our own service and then come back, about half a dozen of us. And I suppose we had it in a field, I believe. And then when you come back, there'd been a call for volunteers, and off they'd gone. It happened.
Thank you very much.